Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. China has been cracking down hard in recent weeks on all kinds of dissent and free expression. Lawyers, journalists, activists, artists, Christians, rounded up, roughed up, some arrested, some, as they say in China, just disappeared. The most famous target of the crackdown? World-renowned artist Ai Weiwei. He designed the signature Bird's Nest Stadium at the Beijing Olympics. A week ago, he too was grabbed. This hour, On Point, the detention of Ai Weiwei and the broad crackdown on dissent in China. You can join the conversation. Are you following the crackdown, the detention of artist Ai Weiwei? What does it mean that China responds to talk of more political rights with crackdown? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from Beijing in China is Evan Osnos, China correspondent for The New Yorker magazine. He's been following the story of Ai Weiwei and the broader crackdown. Evan Osnos, welcome back to On Point. Thanks very much for being with us. Evan, give us a sense first of just the breadth and depth of this crackdown. What brought it on and who's being swept up in what kind of police and otherwise action?
What's remarkable about this crackdown and what sets it apart from previous experiences over the last few years is that this crept up almost quietly in a way. I think it had to do with the fact that there was so much news going on overseas. Of course, Libya was gathering the headlines. There was the crisis in Japan. And so it took a couple of weeks before a lot of us who live here and who spend time specializing in the region realized just the full contours of what was happening. And what was happening was quite remarkable. Beginning around the time of the uprisings in the Middle East, in Tunisia and Egypt, China began to round up the people who it thought stood the greatest chance of causing trouble in its own sense of the word, on Chinese soil. And that meant lawyers and activists and writers and eventually artists. And we had a total of about 30 people who disappeared, about 200 people who were placed under house arrest, about another 25 people who were formally charged. And some of those people were eventually released. Some of them were allowed to be were released from house arrest. But you also have a number of cases of people who have been now charged with very serious offenses and are looking at jail time of 10 years in some cases.
Describe the resources that are being poured into this, Evan. We're hearing kind of amazing reports about the number of security people across the whole country, some going after big fish like Ai Weiwei. We'll talk about him. But others just going after little bloggers, anybody whose head sticks up above level at this moment.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. One of the things that's quite striking about the last couple of years in China is the way in which the security structure has swelled to fill an enormous slice of life here. I mean, I'll talk to just about it from a personal perspective for a moment, which is that if I step outside the front door in my neighborhood, and this is not directed at me, this is just directed at anybody in the neighborhood, there are security cameras on the telephone poles in the alley. This is a small alley in the middle of Beijing. Then if you walk down the street to the intersection, there are more security cameras facing both directions. And then if you go another 50 meters down the road, you get another cluster, another hive of security cameras. So there has been this massive investment in the electronic infrastructure of surveillance, and that applies to telephone calls, it applies to the internet, and it certainly applies to the ability to find the people who are perhaps meeting on the street if there's people there collecting for a demonstration, and to zero in on it. So to put it in perspective, China now spends $95 billion a year on domestic security. That's security to preserve stability at home. And that's more money, in fact, now than it spends on its whole foreign military budget, which is a remarkable fact when you really think about it.
Why this crackdown now, Evan? I mean, is it that China has become gradually more progressive over the last, I don't know, decade or so, and suddenly the Communist Party says, well, this is more than we can manage? Could it really be that big, mighty China is worried about the example of the Jasmine Revolution in little Tunisia and even Egypt?
This is one of the things that can be baffling about it. I mean, there are moments where we look at what's happening here, and it looks like an elephant afraid of a mouse. I mean, this is the case where you have this enormously successful economic power shuddering at the presence of an artist. It's a bizarre phenomenon to watch, but you have to look at it for a moment from China's perspective, from the official government perspective. What they see when they look around history and they look around the present day is that they see that societies that allowed, well, I should say authoritarian societies that allowed a glimmer of unrest to enter into the political environment were then prone to greater unrest and eventually the downfall of the regime. And they look in very, it's not subtle. They talk about it in very explicit terms. I mean, I read about it in Chinese academic literature. They'll talk about the fact that the reason the Soviet Union fell apart was because Gorbachev, in the Chinese official analysis, Gorbachev failed to do what he should have done, which was to prevent unrest from widening when it began. And as a result, the Soviet Union doesn't exist. And they're acutely aware of that here in Beijing, and they'll do anything, almost literally anything that they need to from an official perspective to prevent that kind of instability from happening again. And it's not, they don't see it as a case of being brutal against their own population. What they see is that they have an enormous population of 1.3 billion people, and that if they allow what they consider to be a small group of troublemakers from undermining the stability of this vast country, well, then they think that a huge number of people will suffer. And that's the argument that they make day after day.
But if you believe in free expression at all, this is really throwing a heavy blanket over that. Introduce us to this one man who, out of all these, is getting a lot of attention in part because he's the best known internationally. As you say, there's lots of others, lawyers, journalists, activists, others who have been hit by this. But Ai Weiwei, I mean, he helped design, along with the Swiss architects, that Bird's Nest Stadium that was so famous during the Beijing Olympics. Introduce us to this man. Why was he able to be so provocative for so long without being arrested? I guess a week and a day ago now he was detained. And who is he? Why is he such an issue to the Chinese government?
Yeah, Ai Weiwei, to really understand who he is, you have to begin essentially with his father, which was that his father was the most famous modern poet in contemporary China. And that's an important fact. His name was Ai Qing, and he's somebody that everybody in China today would have read as a high school student.
Yep.
So his son began life in this environment of an intensely creative atmosphere, but also one that was defined very much by dissent and the dangers of dissent. His father was thrown into domestic exile in the 1950s and 60s and spent most of a 20-year period living in what the Chinese call Little Siberia, way out in far western China in the desert.
And that can sound gentle, but it wasn't. It was pretty brutal. I mean, living in caves, cleaning public toilets, really squashed down. He tried to commit suicide several times.
Yeah, he did. And the son grew up in that environment. It was very much, I mean, he's talked to me about the impact that had on him. That was, as he put it, he saw his father go through the worst moments in his life. And yet he survived, and he survived as a creative person. And his father kept writing, in fact, even after he came back from exile. A lot of his readers thought that he was already dead when he returned from far western China in the late 70s. And he kept writing and remained a thorn in the side, in some sense, of the authorities. But the son, in his own ways, has taken that same tradition of dissent and brought it into another era. And he became one of the most active Chinese citizens on Twitter and on other forms of social networking, and he used his blog in very active, very provocative ways to start chipping away at government projects and to criticize them, for instance. So that became that he went from being a classical artist in the sense that he began his career doing in a lot of cases he did ceramics, he would do performance art, he began actually as a painter, though he never thought he was much of a painter. He was inspired most of all by Duchamp, and he did a lot of very sort of droll conceptual pieces of art. And then later in his life, when he became more overtly political, he shifted his focus and began to really blur the line between activism and artistry at all. And I once asked him, are you an activist or an artist? And he left it very clear. He thought that was an incredibly boring question.
He helped design the Bird's Nest Stadium and then distanced himself from the Beijing Olympics. He said they were a kind of fake smile on the face of China. He was extremely critical of the Chinese government in the aftermath of the big Sichuan earthquake and what he saw, I guess, as corruption that had gone on in a lot of the building there, the governments that led it to fall down on school children, among others, and the government's unwillingness to really put out chapter and verse of what had happened there, even published the names of those kids. I guess that really put him out front, Evan.
That really was his first big political issue, in a sense. I mean, it was right around the certainly his involvement in the Olympics and then eventually his disavowal of the Olympics was important, but it didn't attract the kind of attention on the domestic side that his involvement in the earthquake did. What happened was after the earthquake, he decided that the fact that the government had not put out a list of the number of children who died in schools that collapsed because of poor construction.
Yep.
He found that to be an insult to the Chinese population, an insult to their dignity, in a sense. And so he took that on as an issue. And one of the first days that I spent with him, we started at his studio, and I expected to spend most of the day there talking about art. But after a couple of hours, he said, it's time to go to the courthouse. And I didn't know what he was talking about, but what he meant was that it had become a part of his life to involve himself in the Chinese bureaucracy. He was fascinated by the system of authoritarianism, and so what he did was took me to the courthouse because he was involved in filing petitions and filing formal motions and orders to try to get the names of these children released.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about China's big new crackdown on dissent, on free expression, and the case in particular of Chinese artist Ai Weiwei. Over the last couple of months, since Egypt and Tunisia, there have been many detained, arrested, roughed up, all kinds of reports, a real crackdown right across the country, the biggest in a decade or more. Ai Weiwei may be the most prominent among those arrested, a provocative artist who, because of his family background and because of his way of registering dissent, had not been before, but he is now. A week and a day ago, picked up as he attempted to fly to Hong Kong and still in custody. Evan Osnos has joined us from Beijing. He's China correspondent for The New Yorker magazine, had a big profile of Ai Weiwei in the magazine last year. Really interesting guy. Big belly, big beard, big personality, and now focus of a lot of international attention. Here's a little bit of tape from the Chinese government's weekly briefing in Beijing. This is last week. Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Hong Lei addressed questions about Ai Weiwei's detention. Here's a translation interpretation from Al Jazeera English.
To my understanding, Ai Weiwei is suspected of economic crime. Public security authorities are currently investigating the case in accordance with the law. China is a country ruled by law, and the competent authorities will act according to the law.
China is a country ruled by law. We'll look at that assertion. Ai Weiwei recorded a video that was played last month at the TED conference in Long Beach, California. And in the video, you'll hear his voice here. Ai Weiwei himself says in order for China to build a more democratic society, people need to act and express their opinions. He says he tries to reach out to young people and get them involved.
Only when you're doing that, you can have a civil society. So what I'm doing is more trying to involve my art with the reality, trying to build a possibility. And to connect art and the social change.
That was going on before. Right now, it's not. He's arrested. A number of his associates have been picked up as well. Last month, there was a PBS Frontline episode called Who's Afraid of Ai Weiwei? Allison Clayman here has asked Ai Weiwei why he maybe looks so fearless compared to other people. He told her he's not.
I'm so fearful. That's not fearless. I'm more fearful than other people, maybe. Then I act more brave because I know the danger is really there. if you don't act, the danger becomes stronger.
I act more brave because I know the danger is really there. If you don't act, the danger becomes stronger. Evan Osnow, stand by in Beijing for just a moment. Allison Clayman, who put that PBS Frontline piece together, joins us right now from New York. Allison, thank you very much for being here.
My pleasure. Hi, Tom.
Hi. You spent a lot of time with Ai Weiwei. Did he see this coming?
I think this is something that he always knew the risk was there, and everyone around him, everyone who watched him knew the risk was there. But it's one of those things, I mean, how can you anticipate if it hasn't happened yet? You know, how I don't think he lived his life in expectation that it was going to happen tomorrow, but that he wouldn't be surprised if it happened tomorrow. And it's one of those things where I, with my, you know, hundreds of hours of footage over the last 2 years since I was following him for a documentary, but any journalist, even if you've interviewed him once, right, you can probably go back to your interview transcript and everything seems kind of prescient or kind of eerie, right? Because it's just, this is the risk. This is how he saw the condition that he lived in. And he was very much aware of it.
He increasingly put himself right in the middle, maybe in the bullseye for the government. In August 2009, he went out to Chengdu in western China to testify at the trial of an activist there. Police came to his hotel room, whacked him on the head, detained him for a day and a half. Eventually had to have surgery to deal with that. But he secretly recorded in the sort of very contemporary way, almost Andy Warhol making art out of politics, audio of that police confrontation. You can hear it gets heated. Have you seen him become bolder in the years that you followed him, Allison, in his thumbing his nose or, you know, provoking the Chinese government?
I think within each sort of quest or cause that he is forwarding, there's moments of boldness and moments where he sort of tries to hold back. And this is what I would say, because on the one hand, it might seem like he had some sort of, you know, wish to be a martyr, but the truth is he knew how powerful his role not being detained was. He knew how powerful it was to be a voice for people whose voices were otherwise not heard. I mean, look, would we even be doing a show about people detained until it got up to his level? And I think that he also was someone who thought that his art was a very important part of his life and practice. But on the other hand, as he does things, goes through the motions and tries to illuminate the sort of Byzantine structures of the Chinese legal system, for example, at some point you don't get very far. And I think he also understood the power of a strong statement of sort of pushing until China revealed itself. And that's how he saw it, you know, that, you know, you can go and testify and, you know, leave your complaints, leave your evidence, and nothing happens and they don't reply to you. Well, that's good maybe once to show how it all worked out. But if it continues to be that way and you just continue to be ignored, what are you really proving, and how does it really distill your point? So I think that it was a balance.
And we certainly don't want to ignore the many others, as Evan Osnos has pointed out, who have been picked up in this recent crackdown. We're going to hear in just a few minutes from the great Jerome Cohen, who follows Chinese law and its application and absence and maybe abuse very closely and has for years. Allison Clayman, standing by there in New York. Evan Osnos, in Beijing, there's a kind of a type in Ai Weiwei that China's known for a long time. I mean, he's acting out a kind of a cultural type here, is he not, in his combination of sort of cultural figure and political challenger?
Well, I think one of the things that was distinctive or that is distinctive about Ai Weiwei is the fact that he is not comfortably a part of the contemporary art movement here, and that's partly because he has always felt that the art community in Beijing is not as political as he wants them to be. And I think he's found it frustrating, and he's been very critical over the years of some of his fellow artists, and it's one of the reasons why he doesn't really have a very close relationship with them. But there is a tradition going back for thousands of years of intellectuals in China who struggle with the question of how much to be a loyal servant of the state and how much to be a critical, loyal opposition. And he struggled with that. And I think what we saw over the last few years was that he found it increasingly intolerable for him to be silent. And he often found it baffling that others could be silent.
And yet so many have been, Allison, he's not necessarily the most popular Chinese artist within China. China's artists have become, it's become big business in recent years. I've seen in any number of interviews where some other artists are not always complimentary about Ai Weiwei.
Well, definitely. I mean, his art is much more frequently shown abroad than it is within China. I mean, he has never had a large solo museum show in his own home country. And I think that also a lot of people who I talk to who are friends and peers of Ai Weiwei's, their relationship has changed from maybe even the early 90s when he first returned from New York and to this point. And I think it also sometimes has to do with jealousy. I mean, his position because of both his art career but also his political status and his willingness to be, you know, quoted in every news article on a particular news cycle having to do with China and being critical. I mean, he has a certain profile that is definitely different from a lot of his peers.
Evan, what does it mean that the Chinese government has crossed the line and said, I mean, maybe he crossed the line, but why him, why now? If he was exempt for so long because of the extreme prominence of his family, his father, is it obvious what made this the moment when he's picked up?
There's a certain amount of the Chinese senior decision-making, which is ultimately a black box. There's literally no way to know from the outside, but there are a few things we do know for sure. One thing is that the context changed substantially around the time of the uprisings in the Middle East. There was a moment in that point, in that period, and some of that was explicitly public, in which China's most senior officials, the members of the Politburo, got together and discussed what it was that they could do to, quote-unquote, maintain stability in China. And it was after those meetings that we started to see a much more severe restriction placed on free expression. And we started to see that the bandwidth, essentially, of free expression had narrowed. What we don't know is whether a decision had already been made at that point to go after Ai Weiwei. Certainly, he hadn't done anything in recent weeks, for instance, that is obvious for right now. There may be, turn out to be something. But there was nothing in his conduct that we saw that has changed substantially recently. I think it has more to do with the fact that the terrain beneath his feet essentially changed.
A month after that interaction with the police we heard earlier there in Chengdu, Ai Weiwei was in Germany for an art opening, came down with a severe headache, rushed to the hospital for emergency surgery there. He sent a message to the police and uploaded photos of himself, ever the artist, in the hospital, sent those out to his followers, and here he is talking about that with Allison Clayman in last month's Frontline piece.
Some photos at the right moment completely changed the history. To tell the truth, no matter big truth or small truth, it's always should be justified.
To tell the truth should always be justified, but it can also be dangerous. It can be dangerous in China. Jerome Cohen joins us right now as well from New York, one of the top authorities on China's legal system, professor at New York University School of Law, retired partner at Paul Weiss, Rifkin, Wharton, and Garrison law firm. Jerome Cohen, it's always great to talk with you. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
What does it mean that along with so many others, Ai Weiwei has now been detained?
Well, Ai Weiwei is a poster boy for Chinese culture abroad. He's been a poster boy for challenges to the Chinese government. And now, unfortunately, he's becoming a poster boy for telling the world about the vagaries and inadequacies of the Chinese criminal justice system. He is in a very unhappy and difficult position. He is a helpless individual detained by the police and virtually kept at their will.
We heard the Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson saying earlier, China is a country of law. How about that?
Well, it is now a country of law, unlike 30-odd years ago during the Cultural Revolution. But the law allows the police to do as they wish. The law is full of discretion. The law is full of selective prosecution possibilities. The law is full of exceptions, that the police are the ones to decide whether or not the exception is appropriate. the prosecutor's office, the courts simply don't play an important role here. The police decide whether or not to notify the family where he's been detained, why he's been detained, who holds him. The police decide whether or not a lawyer can see him. The police decide how much the lawyer can talk to him if a lawyer eventually does get to see him. The police decide how long to hold him. The police decide whether or not to bring the prosecution. They and the party, and they overlap, really are the effective controllers of Chinese law and the legal system.
That's a lot of discretion. That's a lot of power. Here's a little example of that attitude. This is from a Chinese foreign minister briefing last month. Spokeswoman Jian Yu accusing foreign journalists of trying to disrupt order is a translation from NTD English.
Some people shouldn't use the law as a shield. The truth of the issue is that some people are afraid of a lack of chaos and want to cause trouble in China. If the person has this kind of intention, then no law can protect them.
Then no law can protect them. That sounds like a very permeable kind of law, Jerome Cohen.
Well, it happens to be technically a true statement because although there are laws, they are obviously manipulated by the police. The police decide whether or not to bring the investigation. Most business people in China do business in a way, inevitably, that leaves them open, if there's the political will to prosecute them, to be victims of the system. So it's a discretionary, selective prosecution system. If you offend the leadership for some reason, then they will scurry around and try to find as much as they can to convict you, not for what really offends them, but for so-called economic crimes. They're now engaged in a very intensive investigation of everything Ai Weiwei has done, everybody he's cooperated with. They're talking to his accountant. They're talking to his business partners. They've hauled away lots of documents and records. They're trying desperately to pin, for example, a tax violation on him if they can. Or there's a general accusation of illegally conducting a business that can be very vaguely defined and applied. So this is a political tool. The police have not shown sufficient zeal to go against huge Chinese entrepreneurs who have cheated on their taxes to the extent of millions of dollars. If occasionally they're caught and it becomes public, they're often allowed to compromise with the police, avoid prosecution, never going to jail, by simply paying their back taxes and perhaps an additional fine. But in the case of somebody who's considered to be politically obnoxious, then economic offenses are called into being, and the police are doing their best now to pin that rap on Ai Weiwei.
Could he be gone for a long time? I mean, the Chinese government put up with that empty chair at the Nobel Prize ceremony when dissident Liu Xiaobo was given the Nobel Prize. Could Ai Weiwei be in big trouble despite his family background here?
Of course, he can be put away for a long time. If he is formally arrested, if he is indicted, and usually that happens if the police want that result, he will be put on trial. But the trial will not be a fair trial. Witnesses almost never go to court in China. Their statements taken before the trial or read out in court, and although the law gives a right to cross-examine witnesses, it's not possible to do that if they don't show up.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about China's big new crackdown on dissent, on free expression, in the case of Chinese artist Ai Weiwei, detained for a week and more now as he tried to board a flight to leave the country for Hong Kong, at least to go to Hong Kong. Evan Osnos joins us this hour from Beijing, China, China correspondent for The New Yorker magazine. Allison Clayman joins us from New York, freelance journalist, independent filmmaker. She spent the past 2 years working on a documentary about Ai Weiwei. Short version we saw on Frontline, PBS's Frontline last month. She's got a longer version called Ai Weiwei, Never Sorry, scheduled to be released by the fall. And Jerome Cohen is with us, one of the world's top authorities on China's legal system, professor at NYU School of Law. On Friday, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton rolled out the State Department's 35th annual human rights report. She urged China to release all of those who have been detained for expressing their right to free expression, as she would see it, and which she says is internationally recognized.
We remain deeply concerned about reports that since February, dozens of people, including public interest lawyers, writers, artists, intellectuals, and activists, have been arbitrarily detained and arrested. Among them most recently was the prominent artist Ai Weiwei.
A Chinese embassy spokesman, Wang Baodong, told NPR he rejected the U.S. State Department's human rights report, calling it an act of interference.
The report on China's human rights situation is full of misleading and logically contradictory conclusions and judgments. We don't think that it's the right thing to publish such reports.
Evan Osnos, Allison Clayman, Jerome Cohen, please stand by. I want to bring our listeners in. Elias is calling from Harmony, Rhode Island. Hi, Elias. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Pretty well. What do you see?
Yeah, sure. So my question is, I've been living in Chengdu, which is in the Sichuan province, since the earthquake in 2008.
Oh.
And you mentioned that Ai Weiwei helps to support the activist Tan Zuoren there.
Yes.
But my question is, in this latest crackdown, it seems as if the demographics of those who've been kind of swept up in this Jasmine Revolution are typically in their late 30s and 40s, kind of this post-Tiananmen radicalized group who have kind of, remained under the woodwork for quite some time and are now, making some statements in which are, going against government policy.
Mm-hmm.
Wondering if your guests could talk about, the demographics. Why aren't there people such as myself, in their 20s kind of out and organizing, on this behalf?
That's very interesting, Elias. I appreciate your call. Evan Osnos, let me bring it first to you. I mean, can you generalize about who speaks up in China and who doesn't or doesn't want to demographically?
It's very hard to make generalizations, but I think on a basic level, there's some truth certainly to what the caller said, which is that we've seen there is a group of people who are have been over the last few years increasingly vocal and comfortable criticizing whether it's rule of law or other ways in which they feel that the government is not living up to its own constitution. And when you talk to young people, for instance, born after 1980 in China, there is, in some cases, among elite students, I mean, frankly, they are the heirs of the kinds of students that went to Tiananmen Square 20 years ago. It is common that when you talk to them, you will find that they are perhaps more apolitical than their predecessors were. They're not as interested in pursuing some of these issues as the generation above them might have been in 1989. But I also think there's a danger in assuming that this young community is uninterested in politics. I think that there's a way in which they've begun to talk about issues of rights, but they use a different vocabulary. Very often what you hear about is that young people want justice and they want fairness. And those are two different ways of talking about some of the same issues. They don't talk about democracy, but they talk about getting what they believe is due to them under law, whether that's the opportunity to get a job in a fair way or the opportunity, frankly, to buy a house and to be able to have a clear sense of ownership of your property. And you hear these issues of justice over and over again.
Is that dangerous, Evan? Is that off limits to talk about justice and fairness? We hear about bloggers whose web presence is shut down, and they call it being harmonized, I guess is the euphemism. But is even talk of justice and fairness out of bounds, Evan?
Well, it's never clear what's out of bounds. What's in bounds one day might be out of bounds the next. And there are days where you can talk about justice and fairness, and there are places where you can. It's not a sort of a monolithic security apparatus, and what you see is that there are times where you can be much bolder than you could be a week earlier, and that's one of the reasons why people get caught up in the net, is because they don't, on any given day, it's almost impossible to know what you can say. But justice is a word that sometimes you can get away with.
Let me get a call from Salt Lake City, Utah, and Constance. Constance, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, hello, Tom.
Hi.
Quick question. This may be a side issue. Our ex-governor here from Utah, John Huntsman, is now the ambassador in China. He'll be leaving shortly. But can we expect any response from him as a person in China, and also with the latest comments, the challenges from both China and the U.S. regarding human rights? And also another side issue, our current governor, Gary Herbert, is a guest this week in China getting the Cook's tour. Any comments on that? What can we expect from insiders from the U.S.?
Yeah, I'll go first to China for that, Constance. I appreciate your call. John Huntsman, U.S. ambassador there, appointed by President Obama, spoken of as a potential presidential candidate himself, fluent in Chinese and Mandarin from his days as a Mormon missionary in Taiwan. Evan, I think Ambassador Huntsman did speak publicly about this, rather unusually.
He did, actually. He gave what was described as his valedictory speech last week, and he made unusually strong comments for an ambassador. It tends to be that the U.S. ambassadors here in recent years have been very careful in their language. They don't want to antagonize the Chinese and do what they consider to be imperiling the overall relationship. But John Huntsman was actually quite strong, and he said that he thought it was a problem. So it was remarkable. I think one thing we don't know is, at the time, some people thought, well, maybe he's doing this in service of his own presidential ambitions, though actually the White House then came out later and said that it was certainly consistent with the message they're trying to project on the subject of the recent arrests. So the U.S. has taken a more assertive position in the last several days, and I think among the Chinese rights community, that's they've taken note of it.
Allison Clayman, we have a question here from a listener coming on Facebook, Kristen, and she's asking about Ai Weiwei's studio. He's famously got his big kind of base studio outside Beijing, but he was wooed to build a second one in Shanghai, a pretty big deal studio there. I think the local mayor, one of the mayors on the outskirts of Shanghai, invited him to try and maybe get a sort of artist colony or a community going there. Kristen's asking about the dismantling of that studio. I think it was more or less bulldozed, Allison. Do you know why?
It's a little bit unclear, just like all of this is about why exactly. But the story itself, again, is one of those times when he really crystallizes some of the vagaries of how things happen in China. He was invited by a local mayor. He was, I would almost say, hounded by this local mayor who really thought it would be a great boon. Shanghai is not seen as the same sort of art center as Beijing, and he thought that if Ai Weiwei built a studio, others would follow. And indeed, Ai Weiwei, didn't want to really work with the government on that kind of invitation, because he knows how architecture projects can get killed for some kind of, political reason, and you're not going to be sure why. But the mayor was insistent he would be able to do what he wanted, and he finally acquiesced and built this studio. And I visited it twice last year in February, and by May it was pretty much done, and it's gigantic, bigger than his studio in Beijing. He got a notice. The first notice was last summer in 2010 that he didn't have the right permits. And he said, frankly, he ignored that notice because he said, how could that be? I was, it was the authorities themselves that asked me to come and build this. And a couple months later, they got the notice that said it is going to be demolished. And the mayor from Shanghai did come up and said, was profusely apologetic. It seemed like it was over his head, and said, there's nothing to stop it. And the really strange thing is that there were two studios that were destroyed, and it was Ai Weiwei's and another one that he designed for an artist friend. So the notion that it's punitive, it certainly looks punitive. On the other hand, they did compensate him for the money that he spent. So again, that's one of those cases. It's really hard to come out and have a single, why did this happen? And is it because it's Ai Weiwei and everyone can sort of of have their own opinions. It's certainly strange. Unfortunately, what's going on right now, as of the last 8 days, is a lot more clear, I think, than that situation.
Big country, maybe dappled attitudes there, but when you get in the bullseye of the target of those in power, you can be in trouble in a hurry. Jerome Cohen, I've got an interesting question here from a listener, Ellen, and, you know, to excerpt a little bit from it, but she says, you know, China's culture and government have been built on hierarchies or obedience, conformity for millennia, Confucianism, ancestor worship. She writes, fomenting dissent is not seen as a positive thing, so I don't automatically view, Ellen writes, Chinese dissent the way I do American. There are ways to maneuver within that system that are different. And then, right, she asks with a question mark. I mean, people are trying to make sense of whether we've got this new, whether they like the word or not, a kind of new superpower that just can walk all over what we'd like to think of as human rights. Ellen asking, well, is it just a different way? Is that fair, Jerome, or are rights rights?
Well, the regime in China, like past dictatorships of Chiang Kai-shek in China or on Taiwan or former South Korean dictators, have always said we're different. We have a different tradition. We had Confucius. We had Buddha. Our people really love to be tortured. They don't feel the pain the way other people do because we don't believe in universal values. We have Asian values. Well, of course, that's bunk. And the Chinese government itself has adhered to at least 25 international human rights documents. They, for example, voluntarily ratified the Convention Against Torture. They didn't say, our people come from a different tradition. Mm. They really love to be tortured. They know there are certain common values. Chinese government now is trying to dismiss them as global values that everyone shares. I agree very much with what Evan said earlier. There is a strong striving in Chinese society today, despite the controls imposed on freedom of expression, for justice, for equality, for fairness. Now, we don't know about some of this because people aren't allowed to speak. A 16-university debate that was scheduled over the meaning of the 1911 revolution that launched the great changes of the 20th century has just been canceled in Beijing because these young people aren't allowed to talk about the meaning of that revolution, which was an attempt to bring about more democracy, more individual freedom, and more progress for China. The students at Peking University, the traditional site of intellectual free development in China, have just been put under new forms of restraint, where those who show signs of independent thought have to be brought before a committee that will help them get over these independent thoughts. This is not only limited to wealthy, well-off, intellectual youth. This is also coming out of the protean villages of China. The real striving for law reform, for political reform in China, is coming from those who are not the big winners in this fabulous economic development. Hundreds of millions of people have been brought out of poverty by this government, and it shouldn't run so scared because of that achievement. But there are many other hundreds of millions of people who feel resentment, even though the objective conditions of their lives may have improved. They see the gap between them and the wealthy is hugely expanding. China now has one of the biggest gaps between rich and poor, and a lot of this wealth has come from corrupt relations between village government officials at all levels and between business people, real estate developers especially. And these are targets of resentment. But the people are not being allowed to express themselves. Police have been under instruction for some time, not only since February, to ferret out in whatever county seat they work in, whatever city district they're in, any signs of independent thinking, because they've been told those are the people who eventually will be protesting in the streets.
Wow.
And China now has tens of thousands of protests, most of which we don't know about. The leaders are a lot more knowledgeable about their social political conditions than we are.
Evan Osnos, you've got a big piece in this week's issue of The New Yorker. You spent time with visiting, five European countries over 10 days with a bus full of Chinese tourists. These are presumably winners at some level in the Chinese economy. It's called the Grand Tour. Do the people on the bus with you touring Europe, you know, do they care about the crackdown that's going on in their own country right now? Do they care about Ai Weiwei or not?
Well, what was really interesting about the time that I spent with them was that it was right at the moment that the Middle East unrest was reaching a peak. I mean, this was at the time when the Egypt unrest was unfolding. Tunisia's government had just been toppled. And I saw a really remarkable reaction. On the one hand, this group of people, exactly as you said, are people that have succeeded in this society. They're accountants and school teachers and young executives rising up in the system. And so they tended to look at the places we went across Europe, and they judged them in economic terms. And they would say, well, if you look at the graffiti in Milan, that shows that this political system is flawed because it can't generate the kind of leadership and it can't make the kind of money that it takes to even keep a city clean. And they would extend that argument to the unrest that they saw in the Middle East. So they tended to see the developments in the world on economic terms. Wow. But over the course of the 10 days we were together, as they began to watch more of what was happening on television and, you know, I spent a lot of time sitting next to a guy on the bus, 19-year-old kid from a Shanghai university, who would read the newspapers as we went, very slowly in English. And as we went, he began to see things that he hadn't read about before. And look, this was not a moment of great drama where all of a sudden the skies parted and he realized that the world was not what he imagined. It's much more subtle than that. But he did, on some level, put down the newspaper after a week and say, you know, the world that I see in this newspaper is a different world than I inhabit at home.
Evan Osnos, we appreciate so much you being with us today. That is a perspective right there that's valuable. We're thinking about all those hit in this crackdown on Ai Weiwei above all. Jerome Cohen, thank you very much for joining us. And Allison Clayman, we really look forward to your film coming out this fall, Ai Weiwei, Never Sorry. Hope he's out to see it by the time that comes around. Thanks to each of you for being with us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.